Hi, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 16th of November. Toponymity is our topic this hour, and the author of Toponymity, An Atlas of Words, John Bemelmans Marciano, is our guest. He is the author and illustrator of several children's books, including Madeline and the Cats of Rome, Harold's Tale and Delilah, as well as another very popular word book, Eponymous. He gives me all these hard words to pronounce. I think I did that one right. Did I do that one right? We'll soon find out. Chrissy's looking at me with a big question mark. I think that's right. He is an artist and a self-professed word geek, and the book, he says, is aimed to be part dictionary, part atlas, and part encyclopedia. But on the way to making this book, it took on a narrative, a jumbled, hypertextual sort of narrative. The nature of an alphabetical list of entries ensures that but one with constantly intertwining characters and stories. And along the way, you just learn so much history, and you learn about the rivalry, and it gives you fascinating histories about all kinds of words, jeans and gorilla and Frank and dollar and Donnybrook. I'm just paging through this to give you an idea. Cologne, coach, Caucasian, chapel, cantaloupe, up and down the river, and the list goes on. And we're happy to talk with John about this hour. And welcome phone calls. I know you love to talk about words, so you'll probably have some ideas of places that have become names. And we welcome your phone calls at 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. Hi, John. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, great to have you here. Toponymous words provide, you say, a story of the best and worst of human interaction. And the book gets at that depth. This is not just a book about words. It does look at human interaction.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, it certainly has to do with I think the best of human interaction, because so many words that become, I mean, so many places that become words. It has to do with trade. It also has to do with the exchange of ideas. You can take a word like coach. Coach is a little village that's outside of Budapest in Hungary, and during the Renaissance, they made the best carriages in the world. So everybody around Europe, who granted was a king, wanted to have a coach carriage. So that's how coach became a word. But that's all about the spread of technology. It's about the spread of, you know, of what people are doing. You also have words that you would never imagine came from a person. I mean, a word like to gyp someone actually comes from gypsy. You have something like to Welsh on a bet. Welsh, the reason that Welsh on a bet means not to make good on a bet is because the English people thought that the Welsh were very unreliable.
They won't anymore, because that's where they're going to be living after the royal marriage, right? They're going to have a whole new word for that, I would imagine.
Oh, yeah.
You say that you live for those moments when you discover an unexpected oddity of word history, and the book is filled with those unexpected oddities, isn't it?
It is. I mean, to me, it's just, it's incredible. And sometimes it's ones that you just say, boy, how can that be? I mean, how can the word beg actually come from a people? I mean, how is that from a proper name? And it winds up that there was a group of women who were called the Beguines in the Low Countries, so like Belgium and the Netherlands during the Middle Ages, and they were very progressive. It was an age where, you know, women really weren't allowed to do anything in society, and these were women who didn't want to just become nuns and be cloistered away, and they wanted to help the poor. And to support themselves, the Beguines, they were weavers. And it was also a period where anybody who weaved, you know, if women are weaving, they must be weaving spells, they must be witches. So because they stood outside of the Catholic Church, and because they were out in the world, and because they were literally weaving, they were just considered to be, you know, they were outside of society. They had a really negative connotation associated with them. And so to be a beguine was really just a complete slur. It originally meant heretic. And then there were actually a group of men who, being as men are, they started to hang around these women. And they called themselves beguines, but these guys were a little bit more unscrupulous. They were more about helping themselves than about helping the poor. And they went about begging on all on along the streets of Europe. And, you know, and I'm sorry, I actually used the word begging because we almost don't have another word for it at this point. But it was because they were asking for a handout, these guys, and they were called beguines, that we got the word beg.
Isn't that, how in the world did you find that out?
I mean, you know, it was really, I mean, it was funny. With the first book I did was Anon Eponymous, and my real eureka moment was coming across the word silhouette. I was just stunned that there was actually a guy named Silhouette. That was his last name. And and he was a finance minister in France in the 1750s, and he basically taxed people a lot. And what people said was he was turning them all into he was turning them all into essentially shadows of themselves. And at the time, there was a very popular art, which was the cutting. It was called shade cutting, and it was how you would, you know, it's that thing where it's just a black outline of someone's face, and it was kind of a cheap way of getting your portrait done. So his name got connected with that art form, and that became the silhouette. So the first book was about people, and that was actually amazingly easy to research. There was just, like everything, like everybody else, I went to Wikipedia, and I found a whole list, and some of them were true, and some of them weren't. My favorite fake one that you can find in a lot of places is that there was a man named Domenico da Camma, who was the first person to punctuate the Bible, and for this crime, he was put on the rack or burned at the stake or something by the Inquisition.
Ooh.
But that's not true. Anyway,
thank
so
goodness.
Like I said, there was a Wikipedia page with toponymy. To be honest with you, the idea of places that were you know, that became words, it was a much harder thing to track down. You know, it involved getting really good at Google searches.
Yeah. The older the word, you say, the murkier its etymology.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can go back to a word like gorilla, which is another one of my favorites. And there was a guy named Hanno, King Hanno of Carthage. And sometime around 500 BC, he went on this amazing expedition that Carthage at the time was located basically in the middle of the Mediterranean. And he went out of the Mediterranean Sea, and he actually followed the coastline of Africa all the way down literally to the equator. And when he got to the equator, they went aground, and they found what, in his account, was a race of hairy savages. And these people threw rocks and sticks at him, and people or creatures or whatever, it's very unspecified. And they managed to keep two of them, I believe, alive, or three females. But they were so unruly on the ship that they wound up killing them. And they actually brought the skins back, and they brought it to their temple. And apparently the skins were there along with Hanno's account until the Romans came and burned Carthage to the ground. But the interpreter that they picked up in Africa, Hanno, gave the word to these people, called them gorilla. That was the word that he used. And what's really amazing about this is that almost completely unconnectedly, a missionary who was really the first to go to this, to go into Africa and really document the gorillas, he used this. He was obviously very, very literate in ancient sources, and he used this word. And at the time, nobody believed that Hanno had gone this far because they didn't believe it was possible. And only recently, people have realized by really looking into his account that, in fact, he had gone this far. So he may have been the first European or first person from the ancient world to have, or maybe the only person from the ancient world to have actually ever seen a gorilla.
I love these stories. So tell me, is this true or not? I love this one, too, because we hear this word all the time now. You talk about the lobby of the Willard Hotel where Ulysses S. Grant, President Grant, was said to enjoy his cigar and brandy, but hated being besieged by favor seekers, the people he supposedly called those damn lobbyists.
Yeah, isn't that a great story?
I love that story. Is it true?
I really wish that one was true.
Darn.
It's just not.
It's not true.
But you know what? What's funny to me is a lot of the fake ones actually make more sense than the real ones.
Right. Yeah, that one makes a whole lot of sense.
I think we should just say
it's true. We'll just pass it along because we said it on the radio.
Yeah.
It must be true, right?
Right.
Asia Minor, you write, that it has yielded more words than just about anywhere. Asia Minor, why is that?
Well, you know, Asia Minor is, and this was something, to be honest with you, I wasn't really even aware of the, you know, contribution to history or whatever you want to call it, or how centered the ancient world was around Asia Minor. And I mean, basically, that's just the western portion of Turkey. And I mean, most famous, I suppose, for Troy. Byzantium kind of straddles Asia Minor and Europe. But it was an area that was. It was the first area to be colonized by the ancient Greeks. And because it was very rich in minerals and other things, it wound up becoming one of their, it really became as Greek as anywhere else. And, just a couple of places. There's the island of Lesbos, which was home to the poet Sappho. There was the Meander River, which was famously windy. There was a great king named Mausolus who put up a really fancy tomb. I think my all-time favorite, though, is that there was an area called Magnesia, and there was a stone that was discovered here that if you, basically, there's many stories about how it was discovered. My particular favorite one is that there was a shepherd who made the cobbles, or I forget what it's called, basically the nails on his boots, he made from this mineral, and then all the nails everywhere would suddenly attack him.
And Lesbos, talk about Lesbos and the word lesbian.
Yeah, so the poet Sappho was it's really interesting. She was really considered one of the few greatest lyric poets in the classical world. And sadly, very few of her poems have survived, mostly in scraps, which is actually, to be honest with you, more than have survived about than almost anyone else. What's really odd about her own name and certainly the island that she lived becoming the word for a gay woman is that nobody is sure whether or not she was a lesbian. It's kind of, it's possibly similar to where, the Log Cabin Republicans are called the Log Cabin Republicans because some people think that Abraham Lincoln was gay because he wrote in his diaries about how he and his traveling companion would sleep in the same bed.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be a very similar thing that just when she writes of her love of women, she actually had a school of poetry on the island, and when she would talk of her love of her students, it might just mean a very platonic kind of love. It's very unsure, but in any case, in later years, dirty minds prevailed, and she became the and that became what lesbian meant.
I don't use this word very often, but it really says what it is, and has a very interesting, it's on page 58, frank, open and honest. It has an interesting history, that word.
Yeah, that was another one of those ones that when you, it's really surprising. So many of these words, like Welsh, or gyp, when somebody uses another, when somebody uses their nationality, it winds up becoming a negative. What's interesting about the Franks is that they actually use their own name to be a very positive thing. So if something was Frank, it meant that it was free, because the only people in Charlemagne's empire, the only people who were free, as in not slaves, were the native people. So the word Frank took on this meaning of to be free, and it's it meant that it was really good, just overwhelmingly positive. So frankincense is really good incense. In a lot of older histories, you'll see the term Frank traffic, which was free trade. Another sort of leftover of this is lingua franca was the language of trade. But in any event, the sense of the word of Frank as just being open and honest just comes out of this very positive idea that the Franks had of themselves.
It's also a good name. It isn't used very much anymore.
Frank.
Frank.
Frank's
like that
a great name.
I
love the name Frank.
I do too.
Yeah, I had my I had Uncle Frank I loved.
Oh. Well, let's bring it back. Frank.
Yeah.
Frank. We have some listeners named Frank we like.
Excellent.
Yeah. Well, let's go to phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. And our guest is the author of Toponymity, An Atlas of Words. John Bemelman's Marciano is our guest, and we'll take your calls in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 800-486-8655 is our number, and we go to Charles from Door County. Hi, Charles.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi. I have two words
okay. That
have an historical significance, but also have a modern-day significance now.
All right.
Remember the story, Fuzzy Wuzzy was a bear, Fuzzy Wuzzy had no hair, Fuzzy Wuzzy wasn't Fuzzy Wuzzy?
Ooh, very good. Sure. You do it well, Charles.
And also in connection with that is the expression, the whirling dervish.
Yeah.
Do you know where those come from?
I don't know where. Well, the whirling dervish, I believe that was, weren't the dervishes mystic, like Muslim mystics from Turkey or something like that?
No.
No.
The whirling dervishes and the fuzzy wuzzies.
Okay.
That rhyme was an English rhyme that was designed or concocted after Lord Kitchener devastated and rampaged and basically laid waste to the Sudan.
Oh.
After Chinese Gordon was killed in attack upon the capital, and he was beheaded by the Grand Mufti. And for that reason, the British went up the, under Lord Kitchener, went up the Nile River, mm-hmm. and basically for 20 years they basically devastated and killed everything.
Wow.
And left it in such a disrespect that for 100 years it has been a tragedy. Then in 1980s, when they had finally concocted and built a pharmaceutical house in the Sudan, supplying pharmaceuticals for the people, an agency in this government known as AID, Aid for International Development, had it blown up, which they said was the indirect cause of over 250,000 people in the Sudan that died. And what is ironic is that on the date of September 9th, or 1911, the World Trade Centers, the headquarters for AID was on the 90th, 91st, 92nd floor.
Huh.
Hmm.
And the whirling dervishes and wuzzies were tribes. There were tribes designated by the British because of the way they attacked camels and horses and created on this desert this great mass of cloud and that. And the fuzzy wuzzies were a tribe that are, part of the stand and the tip of Africa there. And they wore their hair very, very... They would make, I think, the football player for the Pittsburgh Steelers would be...
Troy Polamalu?
Yes.
He might be a fuzzy, was he?
That's going to be in my head all day now, fuzzy, wuzzy, wuzzy bear. Thank you, Charles, very much for your call. The word cologne.
Cologne, yeah. So cologne is a town in Germany, and there were actually a pair of Italian men who They were from the very most northern part of Italy and from a very desperately poor part, mountainous part. And they came to Cologne. It was very pop. It was a very popular city for immigrants because it was in the during the Renaissance, late Renaissance, because it was because it was very prosperous. So they actually formulated this recipe, and they sold it under the name Eau de Cologne. Up to that point, perfume was actually called toilet water.
That was not a good name.
Not a good name. Mm-mm. So obviously something in need of a new word.
Right.
And Eau de Cologne was incredibly popular. And the secret ingredient was actually bergamot or bergamot. And that is, it's a small citrus fruit that I'm particularly interested with because my family is from the part of Italy. It's on the absolute tippy tip of the boot. And it only grows in an 8-mile wide swath.
Oh, my, really?
Yeah. It's the only place in the world that grows, at least that can be used in cologne and in perfume. And it's used in over half of the world's perfume. It's also the key ingredient in Earl Grey tea, which is why when you sniff Earl Grey, it kind of smells like perfume.
Hmm. And does it, I don't drink a lot of Earl Grey tea. Does it taste like it a little bit, too?
It tastes a little bit like it. And
really?
You know, it's funny, I never liked Earl Grey, but then when I found, I was very patriotic about it. When I found out about that, ever since then, it's the only tea I drink.
Oh, I'll have some today.
That's
quite a story. Let's go to Rick from Madison. Hi, Rick.
Hi.
Hi.
The word I'd like to share with you is posh.
P-O-S-H,
you know, as in...
Yeah, it's a good word. Posh.
I learned this from my uncle. He worked in India for about 16 years and, of course, met many of the British, the ex-colonialists and all that. And the word comes from back when people used to travel to India from the U.K. On ship around the Cape of Africa. And if they were buying a higher-class ticket, they would want a ticket on the side of the ship that would see land, that would go along the shore of West Africa, Southern Africa, and that would be port out the left-hand side of the ship. And on the way back, they would do the starboard side of the ship, the right-hand side, which would be starboard home. And that's where posh came from.
Oh.
Say, how did you travel? And they'd say, oh, I traveled posh.
Now, can I be a complete killjoy?
Yeah, go ahead.
Unfortunately, that one is an urban legend.
Oh.
Oh, really?
It is. Yeah. It is. And it's one of those ones, it's one of my favorites, and it's one of, like, the best examples of it. It's really interesting. There was this real fad in the, I think, maybe 40s and 50s for acronyms. People suddenly started to come up with all of these all these urban legend acronyms popped up. That's one of the great ones. There's, of course, another one, foreign lawful carnal knowledge. There are some that are actually, this is a time where laser is an acronym. Snafu is one that actually is truly an acronym, which is situation normal all fouled up.
Oh, it's interesting to learn that. I'll stop sharing that with people.
But you know,
oh, I'm sorry. It's a wonderful story.
Okay, it's good to get it corrected, but I'm enjoying your show.
Oh, thank you.
So much. Thanks. Well, you can always tell that story and say, but you know
yeah,
what?
You know.
It's not true.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, it is great. Let's go to, when you think about it, a lot of these words come from a time when we paid much greater attention to what was going on around us because we didn't have television and all of that. The breeze, the gentle wind. I love that entry.
Yeah, I mean, again, one of those ones that just completely shocked me. So breeze is, it's a word from Spanish, brisa. And it's essentially it's a wind that comes out of the. I always get my cardinal directions are terrible. It always comes out of the northeast, and essentially it's. But it was the trade wind that basically brought Columbus from Spain, actually from the Canary Islands. So he went to Spain to the Canary Islands, and that brought him to the Caribbean. So for years, many years. Brisa or breeze was only used in terms of the trade wind. The way it got changed was in the tropics, it's just so incredibly hot that, but the breeze, the trade wind blowing on the island on shore was just such a, was really the only way that you could be refreshed. So it just eventually became, just came to mean any gentle, refreshing wind.
And there are other breezes talked about in here too. Can you talk about that? The Caribbean word, English spelled as the hurricanes.
Hurricanes are really odd one. Hurricane is one of these words. You know, spellings take a while to kind of get solidified, especially when they're being translated from another language. So hurricane, which is really like oregano. I wish I could actually spacing on what some of the other ones are. But
page 28 in your book.
28 in my book. That is very helpful. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So here we go. So here's a list of some of them. Forkin, Huarachana, Harry Kane, and here's my favorite, Hurlicano.
Huh.
And Hurlicano is a great, it's actually another great example of how sometimes words just sound right. I mean, you know, we change them just because, I mean, you have a word like, which is probably much closer to the original, like Huarachana, but Hurlicano, you know, it's hurling things around. It's a hurricane. It's a hurricane, and I think probably a word like breeze too. Just breeze. It sounds like a very gentle wind. And actually, again, you really do get these words that because of the way they sound. I mean, we actually do use words for those reasons.
And you go on in that description as well. Tornado.
Yeah, tornado. It's funny. I always just thought of it as being in Kansas, but it was actually it was a very specific navigator's term for. The just sudden tropical thunderstorms that would pop up in the southern Atlantic.
Mm-hmm. Breeze is a lovely word, isn't it?
Isn't it a great word? I love
that word. Soft breeze.
Yeah. Just makes you feel better.
It does make you feel better.
Yeah.
Our number is 800-486-8655 if you'd like to join our conversation. Our guest is the author of Toponymity, an Atlas of Words. This has an interesting history, and I didn't realize these weren't around until, well, they didn't catch on until long after they were invented. Bikini.
Bikini, yeah. Bikini was invented in the 1950s in Paris, and it was essentially in the late 40s after the war was over. And you know, Normandy Beach was obviously people weren't summering on Normandy Beach during the war. But once the war was done and prosperity started to return to Europe, everybody started hitting the beach, and Europe suddenly had a beach culture, kind of like what happened in America in the 60s. And there was a French designer who came up with a two-piece, which was very racy at the time, called the Atom. And, you know, as people are always trying to better each other, another clothing designer came along who decided he would have an even smaller piece of swimsuit, and he called it the bikini. And the really shocking thing about the bikini was that the navel was actually exposed, which even the Atom did not have exposed. But the way he came up with the term for it was shortly before he exhibited it on a runway in Paris. The U.S. started their nuclear testing on the Bikini Atoll, and so it was just one of these things that was it was a huge sensation. Everybody around the world was talking about it, and essentially this designer, to sort of get some press, decided, okay, what's a better name than the Bikini? I'm looking to create a sensation.
Mm-hmm.
And he even in that first fashion show actually printed headlines on his bikinis, on his swimsuits.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it didn't really catch on until the 60s.
No, it didn't really catch on until Brigitte Bardot and
what is that song?
Itsy Bitsy, teeny weeny,
yellow
polka dot bikini.
Bikini. That I wore to the da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Let's go to Dave next. Hi, Dave from Dubuque, Iowa. Hi, Dave.
Hi, how you guys doing?
Fine, how are you?
Good. The one I really like is joshing. When someone says, you know, he's joshing you, and let me know if this isn't some urban legend. I hope it's not. But is that it was the first man, I believe, over in Europe who was the first counterfeiter of gold coins, who either had the first or last name of Josh. So from that day on, it said, you know, watch out, you're being joshed. Is that correct?
You know, I am actually, you know, it's kind of, I have to say, I had thought that I was beyond hearing new ones because I did an anoponymous, I did that a couple of years ago, but I have to say that that one's totally new. And I'm just, that one's totally new to me, and I'm and thank you for bringing that up. I actually just, I just quick checked an etymological dictionary, and apparently some people thought it was a U.S. humorist named Josh Billings. But the word actually appeared before him. And then they also say that it might have something to do... actually, it says that it's basically unknown where it comes from. But it must have come from some Josh, right?
Yeah, and that's what I heard, that when, you know, that he was taking just, you know, in essence, just, you know, silver coins and stuff and doing gold plating over the top.
No, that's really funny. Do you have an idea? Was any year attached to that?
I don't know the year, but I'm almost positive it's European. I think even in England, where he first started it, when they discovered him, that's where the term, you know, you had been joshed. If you'd come across this fake coin that was just, in essence, just a gold vermeil, just covered in gold.
You know, and I have to say that that's actually, there are a lot of very similar etymologies that have... That have come up like that. So I wouldn't. There's actually a word. It's kind of an endangered English word called a pinchbeck, which means counterfeit or cheap or worthless, something like that. And but that word was very popular. I mean, up through the 19th century. And there was actually a guy named Christopher Pinchbeck who marketed jewelry out of imitation gold.
Okay.
So yeah. So I completely believe that.
Yeah, I'd love to find out. You know, if you come back on, if that could be confirmed,
I will definitely look into that. Yeah, if you leave your email with the producer, I will tell you what I turn up.
All right, Dave.
I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Great. We'll get your email and make a connection. Our show seems to be about connections today. Scott in La Crosse. Hello, Scott.
Hey, Kath.
Hi.
Let me just take a minute here to say I just love the variety and the interesting programs you put on, you know, so often. It's just, God, I love this part. And here we are again. So, sir, I got a question for you.
But can I just first say something?
Yeah, you could, of course.
Actually, La Crosse is not the origin of the game. The town is not the origin of the game, so unfortunately that's not a toponym.
Oh, darn.
That would have been a great one.
Yes, it would have.
Actually, sir, that's not my question. I'm
I know. Sure.
Here it is.
Okay.
And I was just thinking about this the other day, so this is really very opportune for me. And it came up with a need I had for a cotter key.
A cotter key?
Cotter key.
What's that?
I don't even know.
It's that little, it's like, well, Kathleen, it's like a bobby pin.
Oh.
But it's you use it like to hold like a bolt with a shaft on it that doesn't have a nut you screw on it. It's actually got a hole in the end.
Okay.
And the cotter key slips through that and actually pinches over it. And they use it like a lot in, like on lawn mowers and things like that, where the vibration would release the nut on a bolt. But a cotter key actually fits through and has a little like a bobby pin, side with bumps on it, and the bumps hold the pin on through the hole drilled in the shaft of the bolt.
Oh yeah, I mean it's funny. Yeah, we just called those. I grew up on a farm, so I used a lot of those. But it's funny. I think we always just called it the pin. How do you spell that? Do you know?
I think. Well, let's see. I've got a dictionary here.
That's all right. So what's the origin of that?
While I'm looking this up, that led me to thinking about other things that I'm assuming. I know, for example, at least I think I know, that Phillips screwdriver is actually a guy named Phillips developed.
Absolutely true.
And then it occurred to me, what about linchpin?
Linchpin. I don't know about that. I will tell you, though, that the word lynch, as in to lynch someone is really one of the most fascinating ones that I've actually ever come across. Just because it's actually debated as to who is everybody agrees that there was a lynch, but there's been a lot of disagreement over who the lynch is. So
the name I heard was Thomas.
I'm sorry?
I heard a name, Thomas, associated one time with that.
Well, no, it was actually, there was a guy named, the one that people think it is, which was a guy named Charles Lynch, who was a judge in Virginia, and just basically he would perform these very summary trials. By the way, the connection with the extremely nasty connections that it took on much later wasn't originally how it was perceived. It was originally just like very quick, mostly frontier justice. The one that most dictionaries accept was a guy named I believe it was William Lynch, who was from Spotsylvania. I think it was Spotsylvania, Pennsylvania, and it was the story with him was that they lived so far away from the courthouse that basically he and kind of a vigilante group would again dispense this summary judgment. And the reason that it's held that actually he was believed for so long was that in a magazine in the 1830s, I believe it was called the Southern Something Messenger, ran an interview with him, and they actually produced his compact, which was basically like this contract that he, or proclamation that he and his people, his raiders had written up about, you know, what justice in their county was going to be. And it's still, I mean, I think the Yale Book of Quotations has it. The most amazing thing is somebody recently discovered that it was a complete hoax, and that the man who came up with the hoax was the editor of the Southern Literary Messenger, who was Edgar Allan Poe, who was extremely fond of literary hoaxes.
Great.
So Lynch in that sense is definitely from somebody. I don't know about Lynchpin, though.
Huh. Okay. Cotter is C-O-T-T-E-R.
Oh, wow, then that really sounds like it must come from someone's name.
That's what I can figure.
Well, that's another good one. You guys have got some good ones coming out.
Well, great. Hey, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Scott, thank you.
Another wonderful show.
Thanks, Scott.
Thanks.
You're a wonderful call-in listener, no doubt about it. Daryl, on the road. Hi.
How you doing?
All right,
I was reading the other day, and I was kind of shocked about the origins of the word cannibal.
Yeah, that's in your book.
Yeah.
That's in his book.
And that it was a Chaldean word, and it means priest of Bel or Baal, and that they would have sacrifices, and the priests would eat the sacrifices, and they were human sacrifices, and that's where we get cannibal.
Well, I'm sorry, where did you say it was from? Chaldean?
Chaldean. It was a Chaldean word, and it means priest of Baal or Bel.
Huh. I mean, it's so funny that, and this happens a lot, is that these words that actually do have these etymologies that are based in people and places wind up getting ones that are either not true or just slightly different. Cannibal actually comes from the same word as Caribbean. There were the Carib or Cannibal Indians, and Columbus discovered them. They were a tribe that actually Columbus had heard about, and they had heard that they performed human sacrifice. And it's not sure. Some people think that they did. It wouldn't be completely unusual. I mean, the Aztecs certainly had a lot of human sacrifice. How much of the flesh was eaten is very unclear. It was something that the Spanish used to sort of bring that they were on this civilizing mission, that these people were savages, and that basically anything that that they did to them was well deserved.
Okay, Daryl.
Yeah, that's I don't know. I had read it in a book called The Two Babylons by Hyslop. It was 1800, written in 1870. I don't know. He was scholar. I don't know. He might have got it wrong.
But you know what's funny is people have been doing, literally since we have writing, people have been imagining or really convinced of what these word etymologies were, and even the word cry. Now, cry seems like another one of these. Okay, this can't possibly be from, you know, from a place or people or something like that. But there was the guards in Rome were called querites or curites, and supposedly when someone was in trouble in Rome, they would cry out, querite, creite, something like that, and the word eventually evolved into cry. And there are ancient writers who say that that's what the etymology was, and but we have no idea whether or not that's true. One of my favorite things is actually Ovid. He would write in that he would actually come up with like two or three different etymologies for the same word and write them all as absolutely true, just to make a point. He was completely unconcerned whether or not they were true or even conflicting with each other.
I would suggest you just tell both stories, Daryl, and ask people to vote. Don't you think?
Yeah, I will definitely take your input under consideration.
Thanks, Daryl.
Thank you. Yeah.
Bye. Let's go to Dan from Nisida. Hi, Dan.
I have a word, and there's two words in a way because this other word has to go with it. The original word was Sri Devi, and Sri is where our word for sir comes from.
Wait, I'm sorry. Say this again.
This is Sanskrit. This goes back before Judaism.
Okay.
Sri Devi, D-E-V-I.
Okay.
And Devi is the word where the word devil and divine come from, both. And they're both opposites, devil and divine. And what happened, this is my impression of what happened, is back when Zoroastrian split from the Sanatana Dharma faith, they took the word Devi, which was the word for God, and they turned it around on itself and turned it into something like devil or demon, you know, what we would think of as demon today. It would be kind of like if somebody split today from the Christian religion and made Christ out to be some kind of a demon. Well, this is what they did to the Sanatana Dharma. There wasn't very many faiths in the world at the time, and so we have the word divine, which comes from Devi, and we have the word devil that comes from Devi, and then, of course, Sri. Sri is where our word sir comes from, and, of course, this is in a feminine. Devi is feminine, if you were to look it up. And so you have Sri Devi, so it's kind of like saying Sir Devi. And this is a Sanskrit. It comes from the Sanskrit. And it kind of reveals a bit of the religious history of the world, which is kind of a little different than what I was taught when I was a kid. I was taught when I was a kid that basically the people of India worship the devil without knowing it. And no, the word didn't exist back then. They did believe in evil spirits, but Devi was actually their word for, well, in a way, God. And so they took God's name. They're actually taking, in a way, you're almost like taking God's name in vain whenever you say the word devil.
Boy, now, I am just going to be, I feel like I'm Mr. Killjoy today. And I love all these stories, and these are the stories that actually make me want to write the books. Devil is actually I'm so intrigued by everything that you're saying, because I know that so much of what you're talking about is exactly the way that these words do derive, and I have a particular soft spot for Zoroastrianism because the first paper I ever wrote in history class was on Zoroastrianism. But actually, devil comes from a Greek word that meant to slander. And sir is actually comes from the same root as signore, which comes, I believe, from a root that means older. So like the term senile. So it was kind of somebody that was respected. But I mean, it's just amazing how these stories, and they're such great stories, is the thing. And I just think it goes to show that, you know, people do love these stories about words and how it does connect to history.
And where do you recommend? Because it is interesting how many different people are calling in with different ideas about words. How do you determine the truth on this?
You know, a lot of times, I mean, you simply can't. I mean, there's, you know, you're only as good as your sources. The Oxford English Dictionary really remains the absolute best. You know, you can go, I mean, a lot of libraries have it. Although, again, they're not infallible. I mean, they have, for instance, they have the wrong Lynch. But there are a couple. I mean, there's a wonderful website called I think it's World Wide Words by a man named Michael Quinion, spelled Q-U-I-N-I-O-N, and he writes some wonderful books. And he actually used to be a researcher. There's also for Posh and a bunch of these other myths. There's a great book called, I believe it's called Word Myths. So that's a lot of fun. But I mean, for me, the most fun is definitely going through the research and you know, learning about learning about what's true and what's not, because it really is all a jumble.
Yeah, thanks, Dan, so much for your call. Yeah. We're speaking this hour with the author of Toponymity. John Marciano is our guest. Our phone number is, and we'll have time for a couple more phone calls, 800-486-8655. Tomorrow during this time period, we have two great guests with us. It's 50 years. We like to mark anniversaries since the election of John F. Kennedy. We still remember him. A lot is still written about him, even though he had a very short presidency. And a lot of what we've learned about him since he was president is not particularly flattering to the president. And yet there is much that is flattering to that presidency. And we'll be talking with two guests. We will have the director of the Kennedy Library in Boston will join us for part of the show, and a great historian, Robert Dalek, who's written several books on the Kennedys, will be with us. So we will mark that anniversary and talk about that brief presidency tomorrow at 10. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Anne from Milwaukee, our next caller. Hi, Anne.
Hi, Kathy. Thank you for your show. And to your guest, it's so interesting. You just kind of touched on this a couple minutes ago, but my question is, what is a good etymological history of English language? Would that be where you'd get the stories? Whereas like OED, I think, is just entries of the first time it appeared and in subsequent appearances of a given word. But what about an etymological dictionary or an etymological history of English language? Is there something that would be user-friendly enough for a layman to use?
To be honest with you, it really kind of falls into two camps, I think. I mean, you have these... you have these etymological dictionaries that, yeah, what they are not is user-friendly. And then you have the kind of books I do that, they're more fun. I would say again, this Michael Quinion is the one who writes a lot of books. I mean, you're not going to get the full etymological history. I mean, to be perfectly honest with you, you know, I wish that there was a book out there that was more user friendly. I mean, I wind up, you know, spending so much time looking at, you know, reading these really not fun to read linguistics.
Yep.
You know, textbooks and things like that. And it's really hard to get at, and so much of the stuff is so fascinating. I mean, I'll just give you one more example from the book. A word like chapel. Chapel actually comes from. I won't go into the whole story, but there was a saint whose capes was a holy relic. His coat, literally, and it was kind of the lucky charm of the early Frankish kings, and they would carry it around, and where it was kept was called the capella, and the person who was in charge of it was called the capellanus, and this word eventually came to be chapel and chaplain. Because it was literally where the Frankish kings prayed. And what to me is so interesting about that is, and by the way, the term a cappella will show you how in Italian they still have the old Latin kind of hard C. But you know, languages change in such similar ways. In French, C before A became soft and became like ch. And another place you can see that is the word chowder. Comes from cauldron, and because that's where they made the soup. They made the soup in a cauldron. And you can also see it in a word like cat in English. Well, it's chat, C-H-A-T in French. And there are these rules, and they're not that complicated. And once you learn them, I think what's great when you learn this stuff is then the whole English language opens up to you, and you can start to see where words comes from. And you see that really, you know, the stuff we speak every day, it's just, I mean, there's so much poetry in it.
But there isn't a book or a number of books that you'd suggest.
You know, all I can really tell you is the Quinian and, you know, okay, of course, my books.
Mm-hmm. Quinian and what?
And his books.
And my books.
I'm sorry, what?
Sorry, my own books, Toponymy and Anonymous.
Oh,
I would definitely
suggest. Oh, I definitely plan on looking at it.
Oh, good.
There you go. All right. Thanks, Anne.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for your call. And, John, thank you so much
thank
for the
so
hour.
Much, it was really a lot of fun.
It was fun. The book is Toponymy, just been published by John Marciano. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour and Chrissy Pease for on-air production. I think we're going to take on trains tomorrow, more from a history of trains, passenger trains and also freight trains, to look at the, you know, how they were designed and why we don't have what Europe has, and would we ever, and what are the plans for national rail. So all of that will be coming up, we think, the first hour of tomorrow's program and the second hour of the 50th anniversary of the election of John F. Kennedy. Thanks for listening.